show you pictures.
Okay, while everybody's coming in, we're going to get started. I'd like to call the Board of Directors meeting to order, November the 18th, 2014.
Lindell, Jerry, we're starting.
We started. First order of business is to approve the minutes. Does anybody have any comments or changes to the minutes? If not, we're going to have a motion for approval. Second? All in favor?
Aye.
Motion passed. Lee? I have a note over here that's in my name. Distinguished new member of the board. Having gone through the indoctrination of the compensation committee, we have a gift for you. You will enjoy this. So that is your compensation for what we've been doing.
That is the only thing you ever get. Full disclosure.
All right, here we go. You're going to have the next item?
Yes, sir. I hope you really enjoy the next hour or so, because what we want to share with you are the initiatives, kind of the forward-looking things, our forward-looking strategies. So we're not just saying here's what's happened, but here's what's happening and what we intend to happen. We didn't send material out ahead of time, so for those of you that would have felt guilty about not reading it, you're welcome. For those of you that like to read the material ahead of time, I apologize. The reason we don't send it out ahead of time, quite frankly, is to make it a little more difficult for our competitors and the press to see all the initiatives we're doing. They can still access it. We'll still give it to them. But by not putting it up on the internet, they have to work just a little harder to get to it. So that's why we didn't send it out ahead of time. So we'll be passing out a lot of material. I hope to make this a really good dialogue. Last year, in the November meeting, we talked about our investment initiatives for the first time. So this is kind of an update from a year ago. And I'm going to ask Susan Chen to start us off on what her team's been doing. And Joan is passing those out.
AT&T's teleconference service. Please enter your access code. The pound. Access code followed by the pound sign. Join the conference as the host. Press star. Otherwise, press. Please enter your host password. At the tone, please speak your name. There are 1 participants on the call, including you. You are joining your conference as the host. For a menu of available commands, press star pound. Has joined the conference.
Welcome, Chancellor. Can you hear us?
Right
now.
Let's go.
If you can, talk louder for some of us.
So we wanted to give our new board members an overview of our emerging market strategy and portfolio, as well as provide an update for everybody else. So there are generally 3 types of emerging market managers that we invest in. The first is diversified global emerging market managers. These tend to be managers based in financial centers, like New York and Boston, in the developed market, with very diversified portfolios of 100 plus securities and invest in emerging markets all over the world. Significant overlap with market indices, and as a result, performance tends to track
Susan and Russ just got back from India and Singapore last week and are still standing.
Yeah, exactly.
Susan, as a point of information, are the benchmarks that you're comparing to investable benchmarks? Like in Africa, it seems like you're lagging, but could you actually have gotten the return benchmark?
Yeah,
Africa's
probably the least investable benchmark. It's the manager. Usually there's a swap available that has cost for some of the markets. There's a cost to investment passive.
And are these pre or post fees?
We never show you an investment return gross of fees. Any return we ever show you is net of fees.
It's always net of fees.
Every net of fees.
Thank you.
I wish our managers said the same.
Okay, hedge funds.
These are getting passed out. The strategic initiative we're going to talk about is the next generation game. And what's an important part of our portfolio is because it serves two purposes. One is we're always looking for top talent wherever we can find it. And secondly, we're very much aware of our succession risk, our retirement risk of our established managers. So these younger new fund launches, we think we'll be able to replace that capital over the next 5-10 years, as it's inevitable that they transition. So slide 2 compares the portfolio today versus a year ago, tranche between the next generation managers in blue and established managers in green. And on the left, we show the relationship count. Has gone up by 2. The established managers have gone down by 1, but the next generation have gone up by 3, which transitions the portfolio from kind of 2/3, 1/3 to 60/40 by count. In my assets, the portfolio has increased by $1.5 billion, with more of the capital going to the next generation managers, going from 17% to 23%. Slide 3 shows the pace of our investment activity for the last 7 years. On the left, it's the number of new investments made each year. You can see the sweet spot is kind of 2 to 3 per year. But most recently, with the one that you just received and we expect to close before December, we expect it to be 5 this year. So that would make us go from 14 to 18 versus a year ago. And on the right, it's the capital activity, which most years are in the $100 to $300 million range. But again, this year, it's about $800 million, going from $1.3 to $2.1 billion cumulative. And as a reminder, that is both new hires as well as additional capacity with people that we already have in the portfolio. Slide 4 compares the average age and experience of the two cohorts. And what I'll highlight here is where we've had the most success is with next generation managers, really in their mid-30s to early 40s, that have had very proven careers at established firms, a lot of progression, and they typically managed both a team and a portfolio before. And that's important prior to launching their own firm. We think that increases the odds of success. Slide 5 shows the background of the managers. It's roughly split between spin-outs of our existing managers on the left and other blue-chip, leading, fundamentally oriented firms on the right. An important aspect of this is it's also in areas where we have very strong networks and we can do reference checks that are critically important as you get to know someone for the first time and evaluate what they're going to do with their firm over the next 3 to 5 years.
And, Lee and Kyle being in the business, Arden doing a lot of investing in the business, I think you would concur that the names on page 5 are a pretty good group of people, pretty good crowd to be running with.
Yeah. Very true. Will the old guys be investors in the company formed by the next generation?
Exactly. typically are. It's usually a collegial departure, and they usually receive backing from the firm that they've left. And the closer we are with the managers, the better read we get on how they perform, which is very important.
So we don't invest in every entity that spins out of one of these managers, because we'll talk to the parent, and you know, the parent can say, that's my child, or the parent can say, I love that child.
And silence says a lot as well.
Well, and whether they invest.
Right.
Absolutely.
The most
sometimes they'll put $1 million in just because it's their child, not because they necessarily love that child.
So the next slide, slide six, shows a bar chart of the assets under management of the 18 managers. It shows the range of $600 million to just under $8 billion. And the new additions in the last year are in green on the lower end of the scale. And the median is $1.5 billion. You can read the stats on the left where we compare the two cohorts, and the median that we established is significantly higher than $6 billion. And the average investment for the next generation manager $143 million, which is roughly half of the $300 million for the established. The weighted average percent of strategy shows how we're a meaningful partner for both cohorts, but even more so for the next generation. As I've talked about in the past, we're usually the largest investor, and we're roughly 9% of their assets on average.
And I would, Ron, I think it's true to say that our capacity, the manager limits, for the most part, the manager limits how much capacity they'll give us.
Right. It's frustrating and confounding that there are so many people showing up to these high-profile billion-dollar launches. You usually have 50 investors willing to invest day one, and they usually take two dozen, maybe three dozen, and everyone gets cut back from oversubscription. So we literally put them in touch with other managers and use our reputation to try to get as much capacity as we can. It's very perverse that they're not even open for business and that many people are showing up.
Part of the challenge, therefore, is we also want better fees. So it's the supply and demand isn't really working in our favor to get better fees.
Right. And on that point, so on our total portfolio, the weighted average management fee is 135. And 19%
has joined the conference.
So it's counterintuitive that the management fee is actually higher for the next generation. Part of that is our legacy 1% management fee share classes from the late 90s of the established managers that we've had a very difficult time replicating this time.
Ryan, to clarify the range, the $8 billion, there's a next generation manager with $8 billion of assets.
Right. So the fund Q is Sorbonne at $7 billion, and fund R is Senator at $7.6 billion.
Now, when we invest with Sorbonne, what were their assets?
$1.5 billion.
And how much of that $7.5 billion is gains?
Over half. So both of those managers have compounded north of last 3 years and 5 years. So the next slide, slide seven, shows the performance of the two cohorts. The industry and our benchmark is in red. The established managers are in green and the next generation managers are in red. And you can see the buildup on the bottom. So the next generation managers have generated $500 million in cumulative profit. Or $2.5 billion market value today, getting 23% of the portfolio. And our established managers, on the far right, the annualized return over this period, our established managers have beat the benchmark by 500 basis points. And the next generation managers have beat them by an additional 400 basis points. Now, a lot of them have only been in business for a year or two. We recognize it's not a full market cycle. We want to know how they grow their firms. But so far, it's working. And finally, on slide 8...
You're not guaranteeing 14% annual return?
we will endeavor as much as possible to keep it up. Slide 8, what I'll add here is to Bruce's point earlier, we are seeing a lot of new launches in this late bull market phase of the cycle. Our bar is very high. We think a lot of them are good and not great. And a lot of times we like them, they're fit, but they're not really a unique addition to our portfolio. They're pretty similar to people we already have, and why hire a 45th manager? It is very competitive, reputation matters, and much like we say at UT football games, we try to be early, be loud, and stay late.
Let me add I want to add a couple things. Kyle, Ryan's worked with Kyle over the past month or so. Kyle asked some fantastic questions about liquidity and counterparty risk with Bridgewater, who is the world's largest hedge fund. They have a global macro strategy, and so they use a lot of leverage. And so they were great questions, and you know, with Kyle's help at Ryan and company, I think really dug deep into that. And my guess is, my assertion is that, and we got comfortable with it, my assertion is that we probably know more about what Bridgewater does and how they do it and where they do it and with whom they do it than I would imagine any LP out there knows.
Yeah, I second that. Ryan and his team went the extra mile. I pushed them hard, but I appreciate you doing what you did and educating me as a global macro manager, thinking about how a $150 billion fund levers itself, and no one seems to know when they're coming or going, or they don't leave a footprint anywhere. So I was trying to understand how it all worked, and Ryan went to painstaking detail to give me develop reports. I did this kind of from the perspective of risk management committee, trying to understand the risk of that one investment. And you and your team did a fantastic job. And I was putting something together for the rest of the committee and the board, and they'll have it next board meeting.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. It was very collaborative, and your market expertise is really helpful. We appreciate working together.
Ryan came in at least once a week and said, I really appreciate Kyle. Although we had one more anecdote I wanted Ryan to share.
Right, so I told Bruce this story a few weeks ago, and he insisted that I share it with you guys today, and gives me a chance to brag on Courtney as well as embarrass him a little bit.
Come on, Courtney, stand up.
So we'll each take one of these. Their wristband in orange and white. Ignore the fact it's more Tennessee orange than burnt orange, but it says WWCS, and it's a West Coast manager. Kyle knows him, John Burbank at Passport.
Who's just a really demure, shrinking violet, right? No, this guy is as big, as strong a bull. He's aggressive.
Yeah. Right, and really, we talked a lot today about hiring new managers, and it really speaks to the level of ongoing diligence, relationship building that we have. But around their annual meeting, they gave Courtney a few bracelets saying every time we discuss strategy, launching a new product, expanding the firm, we think about what would Courtney say inside the room. And that's what the bracelet stands for.
So show them the bracelet. It says WWCS.
Yeah.
What would Courtney say? We think that's a good partnership.
It's not a quiet.
Before we move to the private investments, I did want to just take a second and step back, because we've had a fair amount of we've had some discussion over the past few months about hedge funds, the hedge fund portfolio. We know that they do use leverage. We know that the fees are higher. We know that we don't have 100% transparency. We know that it's not fully liquid, and yet we have 30% of our portfolio in hedge funds. And then there was some big news a month ago when CalPERS, because they're so large, got out of hedge funds, and so it just raises the question. And so I just wanted to take a minute, and because we want to make sure that we're acting responsibly as your agents, UTIMCO board, the Board of Regents. And so if there are any continuing questions, concerns, issues about what we're doing in hedge funds, how we're doing it, I want to make sure that I listen to that so that we can respond appropriately. Okay, the next segment is privates, and I'm going to kick this one off, but we'll get these real quickly. Again, I apologize for having to go through this, but as you can imagine, this is kind of our core strategies here, so we are transparent and open, but that doesn't mean we have to make it easy. Sorry. Thank you. So I just want to talk to the first page, which is that, and then I'm going to let Mark Warner and Mark Schoberg and Linda Leckman take you through what they're doing. But as a group, we've kind of developed certain strategies, a certain belief about privates. One is we want a concentrated portfolio. We found in our general private equity book, we probably got overly diversified. And if you get overly diversified, you're just going to get average returns. And average returns are not compelling in private investments. And so we want concentrated portfolios, which means we need to make larger investments with a core group of partners. We believe smaller funds outperform larger funds and can generate superior returns. They tend to operate in less competitive capital markets. Now, so the dynamic of needing to write larger checks and smaller funds means we really need to be a large percentage of that fund. And finally, we believe that, you know, a lot of our job is to identify talent before other people do. And so we can identify them and secure that talent for our fair share. And so we work on that. So we use a number of phrases around here. We talk about strategic partnerships. You know, one aspect of that is we sponsor the fund. It's a UTIMCO-sponsored fund. In many cases, we are putting them in business as either their sole but certainly their most substantial investor. We understand we're covering their overhead and giving them some capital to begin to establish track record. In exchange, we look for advantaged terms and governance. We look for co-investments. It's a way to concentrate more fully with that manager and their best ideas and also to get better economics yet, and we're really looking for a long-term mutual relationship. So those are some strategic principles that have been guiding us. The next page just shows how each of the different teams have begun to focus in their respective areas using these principles, and they're going to talk about it, so I won't spend time on that page. I'll ask Mark Schoberg to tell you, give you an update on what they've been doing in real estate.
As I walk through these slides, I hope to convey that we execute on the initiatives we've outlined here. And then really, as I think about sort of, you know, going through this process, I really enjoyed the exercise because I think it's really important to realize how much progress we've had over the past 3 years. You know, it's anecdotal, but I think about 2010 when we'd go have manager meetings and we would show up and they would sort of, the first question was like, you didn't realize you real estate investment, you know, we're active in this space. And we just, you know, we were out on the ground a lot, meeting with a lot of managers. And fast forward a couple of years, we started having meetings where we show up and they say, you know, we're really excited about this meeting. We've heard you are entrepreneurial and think about things differently. And that you're going to be a successful real estate space. And fast forward today, we're getting a lot of referrals. So groups that we've worked with, we've sponsored, developed deep relationships with, or make referrals. Getting inbounds of, hey, we've heard, you know, so-and-so told us that you're active, provided good guidance through their process if they were thinking about it. So just thinking about that cycle, we feel like we're in a really good place today. You know, as you know, we turn to slide 5 here, it highlights our investment activities for fiscal year 2014. And the intent really is to show you, walk through the individual investments here, but to demonstrate how we've targeted our activities. The key point I want to make is that the large percentage of our deals have been large.
and we've been focused on these specific initiatives. 65% of our capital is committed as the largest investor, but 45% of that investment management is considered strategic partners. We really think this is important because it helps us drive our co-investment opportunities, gets us prioritization with our managers, and often we're able to get approved rights, economic terms, and governance. You know, our ability to influence our managers is actually enhanced further when we're out there and able to sponsor and put our managers in business, as we did with WeLock and Netto here. Counting some of our co-investment activity, WeLock and Netto represent just over a third of our total activity in the fiscal year. The slide also highlights that we've been focused on our initiatives. All of our activity was really focused on manufacturing or creating core properties to sell to high net worth and marketplaces paying low cap rates, highly stabilized assets. 65% of the claims we made were within operating or platform. This is really important. They provide really deep value add capabilities in their platforms. And they also provide the ability to help us capture more of the upside investments. Lastly, targeted in niche opportunities, we're also a focus of ours. Let's say we were our community were a little light in this area. We have a large amount of exposure to the space already, and we maintain a really high bar for it. We also spent a really considerable amount of time in the spectrum space, got really close to the investment, and ultimately didn't consummate it. And we found some complexities in structure and opportunities. On slide 6, you'll see it highlights our current portfolio composition. Position of the portfolio today. A lot of the chart highlights our manager concentration. 5 managers represent 47% of our total exposure, and 10 managers represent 76%. I think it's a good balance to give us good diversification across the portfolio, but also the ability to maintain concentration before we develop more meaningful relationships with our managers. Pie charts at the top show that we're diversified by region and property type. We've seen a dramatic shift in our portfolio since over 2010. At that time, North America represented about 49%, and Western Europe was 12% of the portfolio. We concentrated our efforts early in the U.S. During this cycle, and we've been building out the European platform over the last couple of years. So also note that Europe represents a higher percentage of our reflected capital, about 25%. We're also diversified by property type. I'll just make three key points here. You see specialty investments, which is data centers, cell towers, market manufactured housing, student housing. Investments are relatively high for the portfolio. I think we'll maintain our optimistic approach here, and we'll likely remain overweight in the area. You also see retail grow. As fundamentals are now improving, and we're targeting specific strategies in this area. The last point, industrial is relatively light, that'll probably remain muted for some time. As we start thinking about getting more active in emerging markets, that's probably an area that we'll have to make a focus on. On slide 7, the three charts show that we've made a lot of progress in shaping this portfolio. Strategic partnerships now represent 58% of the total book, 38% in 2010. We're now the largest investor in over half, or approximately half of our investment. 9%. And co-investment activity is now starting to follow. Today, approximately 6.5% of the portfolio is via co-investment. And we're now seeing some more steady, consistent flow now that we have relationships in place. Slide 8 highlights the portfolio's performance on a 1, 3, and 5-year basis. Early, but we think our strategy enhancements are helping drive the progress of the portfolio's performance on investments made 2 to 4 decades. As investments made 2 to 4 years ago are starting to pay dividends. Broader portfolios outperform the Cambridge Private Real Estate Index on a 1, 3, and 5-year basis. Further, the outperformance is amplified when we evaluate the existing team's commitment activities in 2010, namely on a 3-year basis, which outperformed Cambridge.
When Mark first showed me this, I said, why do you get to, you know, you can't cherry pick your portfolio, you can't just start it in 08. And he said, well, that's when he got here. And by the way, I always start my performance when I got here, so why can't you do what I do? And I thought that was a pretty good explanation. So that's why you see the X208.
How do you think about investing in an environment where you might see rates moving up? How do you think about breaking down performance between alpha in real estate versus rates going down? What's your effective duration? How do you think about it compared to a bond?
Yeah, so two things I'd highlight here is that we're maintaining a pretty optimistic approach, and we're really focused on that bifurcation. So we still see a pretty good buffer non-core assets. And our managers and the strategies we're pursuing are trying to sort of quickly get in, stabilize, and sell, and capture some of that compression. As you see rates move up, we think there is a little bit of a spread buffer, so there's probably some movement that would occur before you put cap rates. And then beyond that, the fundamentals are so strong, you'll at least need some of the upward. And then the last thing I'd say at the end of the day, given the spread we see, we feel better playing in that non-stabilized opportunity. So we can still get that upward. Not as tied to compression, but at least some compression.
Is the cap rate closest tied to, say, the 10-year rate or the 5-year rate? Or where on the curve should we think about?
I'd probably say more 10-year, and it's probably a little more oriented towards corporate bonds.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks.
Mark, this is very helpful for me, just to make sure I understand the chart on page 5.
Sure.
Is this saying we put up all the money for the equity for a hotel here? Yeah, what are you guys talking about?
That is saying, so for the co-investment opportunity, we were the only co-investment provider in that opportunity. So the fund may be taking down, call it 80% of the total.
The fund took its maximum.
And then they offered co-investment to some level of LPs. This was the case where we were all the capital. We got all the co-investment.
So I'll be
prioritized.
So we were not the equity investor in a Paris hotel for $11 million.
You're not the only
100% investor.
Right.
Our fund manager.
On a basis to what the fund manager does, we make attempts.
Do we remember Scott here? Was this the thing you did with Scott's?
Yeah.
Do you remember how much they took in the fund?
I think it was somewhere in the $70, $80 million range. We were just the top one.
I just wanted to make sure I stay there and support it.
It's a nice one. By the way, this is a great example. Scott reports to Lindell in our private investment team, focuses one of his areas of expertise is what we call our credit-related managers. They're really kind of a global multi-strategy manager, but they're the ones that identified that provided this co-investment after they filled their fund up with it. That's one of our criteria. It was a real estate deal, so he threw it over to his partner, Mark.
So to highlight there, I think co-investment, a big worry of ours is always for this adverse selection. When we see it, in that regard, we really focus on who are the managers we work with, we're strategic, we're really important to them. In some sense, they don't want to mess it up, right? So if we see something, there's something very important. That's sort of one of the criteria of a lot of that. And then secondly, when you look at the percentages of what we have, I think it highlights that we do get some preferential priority treatments. We're often getting bigger slug co-investment than we are necessarily co-investing.
How do we think our co-investors are doing?
Good. Our I don't have the numbers handy, but on co-investment, I think we're kind of 12%.
It's so too early.
We're getting early marks, but it's
too early to tell. Some of our early co-investments, we had a 5-bagger in natural resources out of the gate. So that helped. Pardon me?
Nothing.
And then we've got, a few others. So
at least I know, now why you keep going to Paris to check.
Somebody's got
to. How do you think about the issue of a manager? So does the manager offer the co-investment to all of their LPs, or do they sometimes preferentially offer
it? It depends. So there's definitely more often than not, it's a subset of LPs. Some fundamentally say we give pro rata rights to all of our LPs. More typically, you see them isolate they'll provide that. In other instances, we've also, and part of what's driving some of this is we've created vehicles where we have discretion. But when we go make a commitment, we'll make a commitment to them in a separate vehicle. It says, hey, here's the vehicle, everything's
Because I was thinking about the ethics of the manager.
Yeah, it's it varies. I mean, usually it's up front. I mean, they're very open about how they handle it.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's a question of just sort of silent on the matter.
We hear a lot of LPs saying they want to do co-investments, but we're set up to do them and we're doing them. Because part of what the GP needs to know is that the capital will be there, that you can commit quickly.
Well, Kyle's often defined the LPA, how they're going to handle co-invest.
Uh-huh.
And so, but what it'll say is often it's at the manager's discretion. It's explicitly stated in there. And then bigger LPs will come in and fight for their rights. They'll get it decided on them. So yeah. You have paragraph on your side there that says we get the first X, we get this. We found that we could be more successful and play nice than sort of setting up these vehicles and being more nimble than the other guys. And a lot of people say they want co-investments, but they don't act on it.
Yep.
So through self-selection, being important to the manager, and being nimble, thanks in large part to the board, giving us a great delegation, we're able to move quickly. And that puts us ahead of everybody else.
And speaking of moving quickly, I should probably go to Mark Warner or Morris to get beat the hook.
Thanks. I think, you know, in our presentation, you're going to hear some of the very similar things to what Mark was pointing out. Looking on page 11, you can see we had a very active year in terms of commitments and investments across our private portfolio. Very diversified, across sectors. We're on page 11.
Yep, sorry.
Very diversified across sectors as well as geographies. What you're starting to see in our portfolio is we're getting more and more concentrated, and that's somewhat a byproduct of the fact we're now moving into the second iteration of some of our strategic partners, where we showed up first, we were their biggest investor, we got preferred terms, they're coming back for their second fundraise, we're investing even more on an absolute basis, and we've maintained our unique relationship with them, and so we're really scaling much more with existing partners. And we are bringing on new partners, and that's changed. I mean, I had an advantage in this portfolio in that when I stepped in 7 years ago, there was just what I would call a fairly minor starter kit. And so I didn't have to deal with some of the legacy issues and got to add a lot of new relationships. And with Bruce's support, the board's support, we got to do some really differentiated things, and we're just now starting to see that really kick in and scale for us. So you can see we were the largest investor with almost all of the relationships we have. Almost all of them are strategic partners. I define strategic as, we all kind of define it maybe a little bit differently. I define it as somebody we talk to all the time, somebody, and that could be monthly or quarterly. We're talking about their whole pipeline. We're in active co-investment discussions with them. We typically have very differentiated fund level terms. A little bit counter to what Linda was saying, we're starting to now put in our side letters very specific language that we will be the first offer to co-invest, or we will get the biggest slice. To your question, Kyle, my experience has been it's a little bit more manual labor intensive if we leave it completely to their discretion. And so when we become so big and so strategic, we can say to them, make us different. Not just at the fund level terms, not just in reduced carry, but also in access to any co-investment. And they've had good experiences with us being responsive, showing up, making investments. So that hasn't been a struggle. So that really kind of defines what was going on in 2014, and I think that, and you can see we only made a commitment to one generalist fund. A generalist fund for us is somebody where we don't have preferred economics, we're not the biggest investor, we don't have a particular unique dialogue. Those folks, to the extent we continue to invest with them, we invest with them because we think they're the best in the world in what they do. That's the only reason. Otherwise, we're going to look for some different kind of partner. Similar to Mark's presentation, you can see how we're diversified across sectors, how we're diversified across geographies, and what I can tell you is this is going to become more diversified over time based on our recent commitments. This is NAV at the end of the fiscal year. As some of our newer partners continue to call capital, this will continue to diversify just based on the commitments we've made. Likewise, I think when you look across the bottom, we're going to become even more concentrated. Top 10, 80% of our portfolio, I think that's going to be higher. I think the top 5 and top 10 numbers will be bigger going forward. You can see on page 13, all of the trends are more strategic partners. You know, it's getting to the point where almost all of our partners are going to fall in that strategic bucket. We're the largest in almost every case. We're always the most knowledgeable because we have sector expertise. We have a guy on our team, Spencer, I think many of you met, who's got agriculture experience. We've got a new member of our team who's not right here right now who has really deep energy and mining expertise. We have really good rapport with our managers because they're all specialists. They're all subsector specialists. We can talk their language. It's almost like being a co-principal with them. And then co-invest as a percentage of the portfolio are going to continue to go up. We've made about $400 million in commitments over the past 4 years. We've got a little more than $300 million in the ground. We've had two exits, both well north of 4X, one close to 5X, one about 4.5X. That's net multiple to us. I think the book overall is trending towards maybe a high twos to low three multiple net to us. That'll be kind of top quartile, top decile kind of private equity numbers. And it's getting to the point when, you know, we grow to a half a billion, $600 million, $700 million in commitments. It's getting to the point where it's going to have $1 billion sort of impact on the endowment. And that's been our goal, to get that kind of scale in our co-invest portfolio. You look at page 14, what I would tell you is the five-year number, while attractive, really, we were just starting to make material commitments 5 years ago. So I would tell you, relative to the current staff and our current strategy, the 3 and the 1 year number are more applicable. And what I would say is, while this shows good spreads over all these numbers, we've clearly benefited from a constructive environment in not just energy, but all of our subsectors. However, I view this somewhat on an absolute basis. I don't expect the portfolio to go up and go down with commodity prices unless there's really big long-term corrections. Our partners, the reason they're good at what they do is that they're good at making money across cycles. And so we're not looking for big, high correlations to the marks in the portfolio from the macro. It'll happen, but I don't expect it to happen in the magnitude that you see in the liquid markets. Finally, going on to page 15, it's just a summary of what we're doing this fiscal year. I think the headline here is we know almost all of what we're going to do already for this year from an investment commitment standpoint. The other thing I'd say to the board is you're going to see a lot of options or reviews from us. And the reason for that is not that you haven't given us plenty of delegated authority, you have, is that what we're doing that's been an evolution is when we make these big commitments, $100, $200 million, we're not making them, we're making them in the first close. So we're going to be the biggest investor, we're going to be the lead investor, we're going to close first. We're making that commitment non-contingent on the rest of their capital raise. So by definition, we may be 100% of their money at closing when we close, or you know, maybe it's a $200 million commitment in a $500 million first close. We're well above the 20% threshold. So that's why we have to come to you for these options reviews. So I apologize in advance, but what that gives us is tremendous leverage in getting these differentiated terms, and it's very defendable to the rest of their LP base. And our partners have embraced that. It's been something they've asked for. So as you can see, for fiscal year 15, we intend to be the largest. We think we'll do at least $150 million of co-invest, maybe closer to $200 million. And I think that's going to be the run rate for us. I think we'll do kind of $200 million plus of co-investment. Those are almost, without exception, carry-free. When you couple that with our fund level reduced carry, our goal is to get our overall portfolio into the kind of single-digit carry net terms to us. And we think that will, just that math is going to help us in our goal to be a top four top.
Mark Warner obviously helped lead us in these efforts. So good to see that portfolio development. Linda will bring us home in the private.
Right. Can I ask real quick? So much of your return certainly is going to be based on the terminal value that you mark. And so this really applies to real estate too. What assurances do you have that it's a clear and accurate mark?
It's a great question. First of all of our partners have to conform with, you know, accounting standards. So they don't have a lot of leeway in how they market. I'll tell you, they're very conservative. They sandbag. You know, when we get these exits, they're not marked. When we get a 4X exit, it wasn't marked at 4X. It has been marked at 1.5, 1.7. So they step it up really closely. They don't get any love for overmarking and having to pull it back. They're very reticent to do that.
Well, and the best guarantee we have is they only get paid on new lines.
Yeah,
they don't get paid on unrealized.
We have full visibility into all of their valuation methodologies. So that's one of the reasons I made that comment, that I don't expect to see a lot of volatility. I think of this as an absolute return to a certain extent. Portfolios, because of that, there isn't a lot of beta baked into these high valuations that are going to pull back with markets.
The only thing I'd add on the real estate side is that process.
All kinds of happy reasons, like accounts and appraisal, but the rubber hits the road. They only get paid on realize, so they're not exempt. Unless they're coming out raising a new fund, then they always mark the
show. You know what we do, Jeff, is we ask our partners, we sit down and say, okay, here's where the portfolio is marked, tell us the range of your expectations. And that's kind of where we tend to focus, is what do we really think is going to happen on exit, what's the range? And that gives us a lot of confidence in kind of where we're headed.
Well, I keep going back to that Paris Hotel.
That relates to the being large advisor.
Mark, how many direct mining companies have we invested in? Have you invested in any that have gone full cycle and exited, or are these the first?
Not yet.
Direct
miners. These are the first. We haven't exited a mine.
You have a Mali and a Tantalum company that we're invested.
So the Tantalum's done. We closed on that. The Mali's in process. They are both with a partner you know very well, who we drug across the line to do a co-in. So we are their biggest investor, but biggest means less than 10% of their fund.
Okay.
We think they're the best in the world at what they do. They just haven't historically done their invest. And so we finally got them to do it. And I will tell you, we were the biggest investor in the Tantalum deal. It was a really complicated deal. It's a very interesting business, but there's a lot of expertise involved in that.
And it's not just the mine, right?
They own Tantalum. It's really more of a processing market. The supply, they've locked up a strategic supply, but the Mali, if you look, Mali's been a tough place, as you know, over the years. These guys are funding the full cycle development of the mine, and they actually really need the co-invest to get them there. So it'll be interesting. I'll keep you posted on whatnot, how that plays out, but we're working on it right now.
Great. I go to Paris. Mark goes to Mozambique and Indonesia. Wherever.
I get to stay at the nicest hotel.
You know, not in the helicopter tour of the
mantra.
Especially in Indonesia.
Right. I took a plane in Mozambique, and that was a.
All right, Lyndall.
All right.
Mark's boss is kicking me.
Our portfolio was a little different than Mark's, say, or Coburn's. Have a big portfolio, and we've been consistent on these themes for a number of years, really since I took over, and it's lower middle market, tech, early stage VC for us, and it's really getting closer to the sectors, and now you're seeing co-investing come online. It's a $4 billion portfolio. I mean, when you try and turn a private equity portfolio, it's turning a balance sheet. And so if we go through some of these numbers, you'll see that the percentages are skewed by the base. But as you look at what we did in the last year, I think you'll see that we're right on theme. It was a heavy VC re-up year for us. We did sponsor a number of first-time institutional funds. But there are people that I have known through venture capital over the last decade where I've focused to them. We fund them out of other existing funds. So I knew them as investors before they became first-time fund managers. If you look at the portfolio, it's mostly small funds. The exceptions to that are MKCP, which is a big opportunistic credit manager where we have a separate account. We have a little bit of a different structure there that allows us to be more nimble. We did three EM managers last year. We did one larger fund at HIG, which is something we think they have a really advanced platform that they've been active. When you look at this page, I kind of want you to think three things. We're executing on the themes we said we would. We are maxing exposure. We can't write larger tickets to these small managers. We are absolutely taking everything we can, playing hard to get that access. And then we're actually seeing co-invest from these core lower middle market managers due to the portfolio we've been building over the last few years.
Sure.
your Paris Hotel competing with his Paris Hotel?
It's the same. We're double counting. We don't want to give him all the credit. You look at the next page, you look at our portfolio, we break it into three columns here. So credit, developed countries, sort of everything but venture capital and venture capital on the right. As you go down the credit column, I'll just highlight a couple of things. Scott's done a really nice job of positioning our credit portfolio, and we've concentrated that book. That's something where we can scale with a few number of managers. So if you look at the very bottom left, our top five managers in the credit book represent 80% of the exposure there. In there, we have two separate accounts. We're well positioned to take advantage of the credit cycle when that opportunity hits. It's been in roll-off mode for a number of years, but you'll see that exposure to the opportunity, the interest opportunistic managers. In the middle column, if you go down that column, at the top, a lot of people worry about our exposure to buyouts. And when they say buyouts, they're really reading the Wall Street really think about high multiples and high credit. But if you look at the exposure we have, there's less than 10% of what we would call huge or mega buyouts. By the way, that's seasoned inventory. It's ready to sell. That I like because we're selling at high multiples in this environment. We have another, call it 15-18% here that some might consider larger buyouts, so what we call medium, so $1 billion to $5 billion of fund size for us. That, too, is well seasoned. We haven't been putting much capital in that over the last 5-10 years, really. That is being sold in this market. Like that too. If you go further down the column in the sector diversification in that book, we are well diversified and in fact have a slight overweight to technology and industrial where we want to be the sector we can focus on. Here at the bottom in the concentration column, the top 20 takes 20 managers to get 80% of your exposure in this book. And that's a challenge for us. This is one where we've been really trying to concentrate and narrow down this portfolio. It takes time when you have a big portfolio. Skip over to the right bottom, there, the concentration of the VC. We've been doing the same thing. Our top 10 managers get us to almost 80% of the exposure there. And if you go across that bottom row of concentration, kind of 35 managers get us to circa 80% of our exposure. That's a change. In total, we have 84 managers. So the remaining 49 managers equal 20%. And that tells you some of the staffing challenges we have monitoring that portfolio, making sure it's performing. I'm going to go ahead and turn the page, look at investment status and IT. Really the three things, and these numbers are all skewed by a very large base, but the things that I point you to, if you look at the top two rows, are that a greater percentage of strategic partners in each of the books across the years, and that we're marching towards concentration. We're the largest investor in so many cases, and in every case, we're maxing out what access we can get. And the last row is co-investment. Today, it's really not that meaningful, but it's growing, and we're seeing a lot more flow. Let's flip the page this morning. I'll just pick out a couple of numbers here. Lord has given me the equal. So I think on the credit-related number, we set up these goals 5 years ago, or we would go farther back to 7 and 10 years. I always look at the longest 10-year or 7 or 10-year possible. That's what the private equity is about, the longer. When you look at the five-year credit number of 15.8%, I think that's a great risk-adjusted number. I'm really proud of that. You come down to developed countries that all the other VC, I'd say that we're just starting to show the changes we've been making over the years. I think that while it has probably earned its place in the portfolio, it's not a great number. It's something we're working on. When you look at our venture capital numbers, they've been great. It's partly the environment, for sure, but I think it's partly the bets that we've made. And I'm really excited about that number. Taking on the 10-year private investment numbers, 14.3%, I'd say good. It's probably earned its place. We're not going to keep up with big buyouts or when equity is really driving through a credit expansion. But over a cycle, we're going to earn 500-plus dips over equities. And I think that earns our place in the portfolio, and I think we can do better. That's part of what the strategy is about. Turn the page, look at the pipeline that we're working on now. It's a big year for re-ups in our lower middle market. As Mark Warner said, you sort of make commitments and they come back. We're in the same place with our lower middle market book. We're also seeing lots of co-investment flow from those same managers. We are their biggest investor. We are important to them. We have great relationships. When you look at the total amount of dollars here, we're definitely going to have to cut back great ideas from this list. And I think that's what you, the board, wants us. You really high grade. It's tough. It's tough decisions for us. In fact, the last couple of years is probably the first time we've been in that position as a firm where we really had to cut great ideas. I think it's a healthy thing, healthy place for us to be. So I hope when we think about privates overall, certainly in our book, think about a consistent approach. It's a long-term strategy for us, what it takes here. And you think that we have a portfolio going in the right path.
I'm obviously real proud of what our teams are doing through. One thing I thought about doing in this meeting, why don't we keep going? I'll come back to that. The next agenda item is we wanted to just give you a taste of what we're also doing at kind of a portfolio scenario risk type of forward-looking level.
Can I ask just one question? In all those areas, when we are, if you look at the unfunded commitments, you know, compared to what we have in the ground, as you say, are we measuring our return? Or first of all, are we paying on the uncommitted but unfunded capital?
Yes.
And are we measuring the return over the commitment period or the funded period?
We pay commitments on unfunded, and when we calculate our return, it's kind of takes into account all the cash flow. So there's a J curve.
So we're measuring over the commitment period.
Correct.
Okay. Right. So we're accounting for the fees, the earlier fees.
Earlier fees.
Yeah.
But there's not a lot of drawn capital, invested capital.
And I would imagine the unfunded amount is growing as you're doing more and more strategic.
You know, it's we follow that closely. It's
well, it's actually kind of the other way. I mean, co-investments, a lot of times the money goes in the ground
immediately.
Yeah. And so, and there's no J-curve and there's no fees.
Right.
So it's a very virtuous cycle when you start adding that in. But the way private equity returns are measured is just net cash flow.
We track our unfunded as a percentage of the total endowment, and it's around 18-19%. You know, we've been in a situation where despite the commitments we've been making, we've been getting a lot of monetization. So we have had calls. We've got a lot of monetization. And the portfolio has been pretty self-funded. And, again, knock on wood, because of the increase in the denominator, the overall endowment, returns, West Texas revenues, the unfunded commitments as a percentage of total assets hasn't gone up that dramatically either. Okay, so I think Susan was going to talk to us a little bit about as head of our portfolio positioning task force, some of the scenario work we're doing. And we've got the handouts here as well. We're almost out of handouts. Second, we'll row at the bottom, gauge the technical positions, shows how much better or worse the
Susan, is it safe to say that after kind of 6 years of up and to the right, that the need for hedging has kind of gone away?
We go back and forth on that. With 6 years of sort of quieter market environment, we can argue that low history is not really those kinds of hedging. But I think where we've come to from in terms of our attitude for insurance is that it makes sense sometimes when there's a high payout. But we do think that the best protection we have comes from our manager alpha as well as
well, and I'll say, so the only thing I'd add to that is our first line of protection is a diversified portfolio. So by definition, with 30% in hedge funds, with a certain amount in bonds and natural resources, we start with a diversified portfolio. Then on top of that, our managers, you know, will hedge, will put on hedges, will diversify, et cetera. As our experience with that direct hedges we put on was what we took from it is when there's a dramatic skew, then it's easier for us to get conviction on that. So I would say that early on in our history, but there was maybe a 3-1, 4-1, 5-1 payoff in some of that. Now we're thinking, okay, it's got to be a 10-1 or 15-1 or 20-1 payoff. So for example, one of the hedges we've looked at fairly regularly over the last 6 months as put on the S&P. Low volatility, you know, high prices up and to the right, low volatility, but the payoffs aren't that great. So we haven't pulled that trigger.
And doing
this
kind of scenario analysis helps give us a framework for assessing mortgages. So we're continually evaluating the probability of a
so in the task force that Susan heads up, we've got members of all the teams, and you know they'll talk about this, and it helps them think about the what ifs. What if we're in this situation and we decide to stick to the policy? What would you do? How would you do it? And so I think it's good planning.
Question I have: so the scenario is kind of before the scenario and after the scenario. Most of these don't happen overnight.
Right.
So do we what do we do about the during the scenario? I think that's really the key of mitigating the after is what we do.
It's hard to know. I can give you all kinds of colloquialisms. We don't want to catch a falling knife, but we also know we're not going to time it at exactly the top and exactly the bottom. And sometimes we may be in one of these scenarios and we don't know it. So again, this isn't, I wish this was absolutely straightforward playbook, just paint by the numbers. It isn't. We're just trying to go through drills and say, if we think we're in this, what do we do?
That's kind of what I'm saying. I mean, the emerging markets are going to be down 20% over a period of time because there's some action to take.
Yes. We don't have a rigid policy. I mean, the rigid policy could say we're going to get back to policy. We're going to rebalance every day or every week or every month. So we don't have that rigid a set of rules. We have evolved in our thinking to kind of getting, we're pretty close to our benchmark. And so when we get off benchmark, I mean by like 1%, 2%, we spend a lot of time thinking and talking about it. And in part because I have 7.5 years of experience. The first 3.5 years, we were brilliant tactical allocators, and we gave it all back the last 4 years. So now we're thinking there's probably a better way to make money.
Looking at the forecasted manager alpha for the external managers, what do you presume they're doing? Are you presuming they're being interactive in their reactions, or you're just saying, given their current book, for this scenario, they're going to do better or worse? Or are you trying to estimate, along the lines of Steve's question, are you assuming they're making tactical reactions during whatever scenario you're modeling?
Yeah, it probably varies by asset class, like private investment, and SEQ, or the
More
so I'll make it quick, I promise. But two observations on the topic we've been discussing. One is there was quite a scramble and a frenzy around LA for lots of reasons, but one of them had to do with, my gosh, this stuff we can look at on real time is down, and gosh, we're going to have a lag on these guys that have got they're going to be 2 quarters behind on reports. Notably, I think some institutions, one's Swenson, I think just mark everything down. So, okay, I'm in balance. We instantly just said, trust me, everything went down the same. The private book, whereas public institutions had a little bit different thing. So I think thinking about what would happen in terms of how you feel about rebalancing, given the lag time and reporting, especially for private book or a bunch of our assets, is worth learning off the first experience if there's something to be learned. The second would be with regard to observing on the tactical and the hedging and everything else. One would observe it's how small it can be, meaningless. Whether it's unwarranted is another discussion. So it's meaningless. So should we keep it or not keep it, or should it be reviewed and be increased, or should it be done away with? And I'd have to say, tongue in cheek, if we all feel like we don't need it, I'm pretty sure we're near the top. And there's more seriousness to that comment than not. But it's so small. Without opining on whether we need it or not, we ought to figure out. Get rid of it or make it meaningful in terms of the energy. But that's a staff thing to think about. Thanks.
Thank you, Artie. It's always good comments. Let's move to the UTEMCO update. It's tab 4. If you've got a paper, it's page 13 on Diligent. We have had some new folks join us. Billy Prather's not here today.
Prather.
Richard Rincon.
He's not here either.
Is Zoe here?
Zoe's just on a call, actually.
And then Gordon Chan. Is Gordon here? Is Gordon? On a Cracker Jack programmer. Really talented. And then I don't think Jacqueline was here last time. Jacqueline's our compliance specialist. Is Jacqueline here now? Stand up, please. Sorry.
Welcome.
So, thank you. And so, welcome.
Jacqueline. They would know Jacqueline.
Yeah. Well, that's right. That's Jack.
She's meaner than she looks.
And then we have the red. We still have open positions we're in process recruiting for. Wanted to just quickly talk about open records. I think John asked the question earlier in risk committee. Sis, you want to give a quick update?
Sure. So for fiscal year 2014, we had 145 requests. The majority of them, 100 of them, were the standard private information requests. This is determined by statute. There's a list of 16 items that were required to buy, and everything else is confidential. So that was the majority of them. A couple of them we were successful in explaining the situation to the requester, and that we would have to request a ruling if they didn't withdraw it, and so we were able to get them to withdraw. And then we always do get a little bit of spam in there. One of our requests was almost 2,700 pages. They had asked for board minutes, for our standard reports, for all the financial advisor and service provider disclosure statements that are filed on an annual basis. The others, you know, the standard reports, those are about 43 to 46 pages, depending on which quarter of information and which year they're asking for. And then all the other 40 requests, those vary. They could be for minutes. They could be for emails of certain people. They could be information on compensation. It just varies. But total hours spent on that was about 232 hours. We don't keep track, but so we just kind of estimate it. But the standard requests don't take any time at all. So that's the majority of it. We've got that streamlined.
And Uche, quickly, IT update.
So, the slide I'm talking on is on page 16 in Diligent and tab 4, page 16 in Portals. We wanted to refresh you, so this is the start of a new fiscal year.
Page 15.
On Diligent. Page 15 in Diligent. So, we thought we'd give you a refresher on our big initiative, which is investment support system. As you've heard about all the initiatives our investment staff are doing, you know, it speaks to the complexity and the amount of data and volume they're working with, and it's started to be a fundamental rethink in how we serve that data and how we input and aggregate that data across the firm. And in a nutshell, that picture there simply shows market data services, personal files, Salesforce manager tracking, investment manager tracking system, Mellon for NAV and performance data, and then personal Microsoft email and productivity suite, all separate. And we're trying to integrate that separately, individual from departmental use of the data. So page 16 in Diligent and 16 in the board books shows how we're thinking about separating that. The top side shows what stages is. I.e., they'll still use best of breed market data services. They'll still have their personal working files. They'll still have their personal emails, Microsoft Office productivity suite. But we want to centralize all the departmental emails, calendars, contacts. And we also want to have at their fingertips all of the Mellon NAV performance data we get from bridges for private markets, hedge funds, direct entry from speaking to the managers. We also want to allow that data to be piped directly into spreadsheets for analysis if they need. And Document Center, which we showed you earlier last year as well, that was an attempt to, what we're doing there is aggregating all of our documents so that we can add, we can show that to the information, the investment information, numbers. part of that picture shows the highlighted sections are sections we've completed or are in progress. So starting clockwise from the top, you see that our document handler is largely complete. We have enhancements to do, but right now we think we're in a good place, so we'll focus on building other functionality. So right now we're working on building firms, funds, locations, functionality for investment teams. This is all around the relationship management piece where we track and report investment manager relationships. We've also had a first crack release at Excel data piping tool. We have a lot of enhancements coming down the line, but the first version of that is already out. We've also brought in house, we've also built a portfolio dashboard where we're showing performance. So that is on the bottom left side of the screen. And all the parts that are not highlighted are the parts we're still working on. This is going to be a slow, gradual process because now we move from all of the documents onboarding to migrating legacy data, which has been built over the line. As you all know, data built over the years, trying to move that into a centralized system takes a lot of standardization, getting intimate with that data, a lot of painful cleanup, and validation by the team. So we continue to work on that. On the next slide is really where we're at right now. So we're working on, as I mentioned earlier, we've completed the first release of our portfolio dashboard. Still a lot of improvements to be made. Staff are still testing it and giving us feedback, and we're going to incorporate that feedback into our next release. While they're evaluating the last release, we're working on the next release, which is the relationship management part of the investment support system. And in parallel, we're going to bring a lot of data transformation and migration. And on top of that, in order to add capacity to migrate to new experience, Gordon is a fantastic hire and addition to the team. He comes to us from 72 Asset Management in Connecticut. He's had experience across a wide range of industries, and this is a huge effort for us. So he's a good addition to help the team show this thing and take it forward.
A lot of work going into this. So I think the last thing we wanted to share with you was give you an update on the our offsite, which Mark Warner helped lead. And so I think we have about 7 minutes.
Ish. So quickly, I think many of you remember we talked about this spring, but Lee, for your benefit, and maybe John, yours. We, for the first time since Bruce has been CEO, we decided to get the senior staff, which is about 15 of us, to go away for a day and talk about issues related to just running the firm. So you've heard a lot about the investment activity, portfolio management, all the things we're doing, you know, that show up in the performance numbers, but there's a lot to managing the ecosystem of the firm itself. And there were a number of sort of pressing issues that was probably time for us to talk about as a group. So we spent about 2 months getting an agenda pulled together, a bunch of information to make it a really productive day. And I went around and met with everybody, and what I got out of the conversations were we want it to be actual tangible results. We don't want to just sort of stare at our midsections for a day and do a ongoing exercise. This is about doing, you know, making some actual progress in some of the things around managing the firm. So many of you have seen this list of follow-ups that we developed from that day offsite. I'm going to let each person just kind of briefly update you on where we are in each of these topics.
So we talked a little bit about how big our portfolio was in general. I wasn't even including what emerging markets has become. It's $750 million in NAV, another $600 million unfunded, something I've worked on for the last 7-8 years, really spent a lot of effort in. Mike McClure also partnered with me. Mike left this last year. We took that as an opportunity. I kind of raised my hand and said, this might be the moment when we need to put more focus, more staffing behind that. I think it's working out great. When we took a look at it, this offsite market, I spent a lot of time talking about it. There's a huge overlap with our global natural resources portfolio. And Mark was kind of the lead, agreed to lead emerging markets. We've also began hiring people to focus specifically on emerging markets. And I think that's important. It's not something that Mark talked about, it's a full-time job. And so with Mark's leadership and new staff coming on, I think that's going to be a great transition. I'm here, and I'm going to transition that knowledge, and I'm going to share what the last 8 years have been about, but it also allows me and my team to focus in if we're concentrating on our portfolio and the things that we can really do that. So I think it's amazing.
In fact, just yesterday we had one of our most trusted partners, private equity, private real estate equity shop from India. They've got a pretty interesting co-investment opportunity. And so Richard, who started last week with Mexico and Scott Bogota, now has his first deal to work on.
Yeah, and just briefly on that staffing, so we're building out basically a separate team for emerging markets private equity. Just hadn't had one before. It's just a subset of overall private equity. I agree with everything Wendell said. We're just going to bring more focus to that effort. Look, investing in emerging markets. You know, emerging markets is not a hobby. It's a challenging environment. But what's interesting is the more we're present, the more we differentiate ourselves as an investor, and the more opportunities it gives us to be strategic. So to that end, what we've said is everybody we're hiring, not just for this, but across the firm, we want them to have some sort of specialty. We're trying to be less generalist and more specialist. And so in the emerging markets, the obvious choice for us was let's get people that at least know regions really well. So Richard, who I don't think is here, but maybe here in a minute, flying in.
Warren Q.
I wish we were that good.
Wow.
Richard is our first hire. He joined last week. He was with Bruce in Mexico, and then he was with Scott in Colombia. Richard, I'll let him briefly explain his background, but he is deep in Latin American markets. So our first effort in bringing specialization to the emerging markets was let's find somebody that knows Latin America. It's our backyard. We should be the reference institutional investor down there. There's no reason for us not to be culturally. So Richard, maybe just briefly give him your background.
Yeah, definitely. Colombian American. So undergrad in Michigan, MBA at Kellogg, spent 2-3 years investment banking out of Chicago. U.S. Hispanic and Latin investments. I transitioned out of that probably around 9-12 months ago, at which point I started working with some Latin American family offices that were interested in acquiring companies here in the U.S. So that inevitably kind of led to us crossing paths. And my interest in the region, I'm from the region, wanting to return and be much more involved on the investment side. So.
First day on the job, first meeting was with a fellow who regulates the cost bank and the banks in Mexico. Then we met with Juan Carlos Slim's sons, and it just kind of went from there.
That's a busy person.
Good. So the other special element that Richard has is he was a private equity principal for 10 years. So he's got direct private equity job that helps tremendously in co-investment, underwriting co-investments. And so both his cultural and his investment background were attractive to us.
Morris said that the time we're over, we can take from you, Jerry.
That's fine.
All right, staff.
Sorry. Mark?
Yeah, you know, understanding the importance of the role staff plays in creating value and providing value. We realize that recruiting top talent and development of staff. Prior to that, Ryan and I met with all the staff, kind of discussed challenges, issues they're facing, talked to them about sort of what's been working well, what hasn't. From that, we sort of come up with some initiatives and some things that we wanted to review those findings with senior management, and then now taking that feedback and working through working with HR to work through
So I think it's fair to say we'll have a junior staffing program where we haven't had one.
And not wanting to get too much into the weeds on that, I think just some of the highlights of what will come out of there is we have a mentor program to staff for everybody to make something new, have a senior manager they can play, talk to. That's likely some of the outside of their teams. Likewise, we're going to leverage some of the analyst training that Drury and Kim have put together. Process, including outreach to other organizations.
Another topic was just how many hours we spend a week, a month, a quarter in meetings, and Brian did an analysis on that, which was a lot of fun, but he had some output from that.
We spend anywhere between 10 and 20% of our time in internal meetings, and a lot of those are cross-sharing of investment ideas, and some are keep the trains moving. So after meeting with everyone, doing an inventory of how we're spending our time, the good news was we had it 90% right. We just needed to tweak around the edges. So just to remind you guys, the meetings that we do take is the task forces, credit and emerging markets meet once a quarter, portfolio positioning meets two to three times a quarter, senior management, Bruce's direct reports, we meet, we went from, once a week for 1 hour to every other week for an hour and a half. And really the major change was using investment committee more. Investment committee is, all investment staff is invited to, but it's really directors and up that serve on that. We review every investment with a two-pager. And when each team presents semi-annually to Bruce on a deep dive of their portfolio, we're now doing more of those, what are we seeing in capital markets, and what are our pipeline discussions at investment, as opposed to just with our team and Bruce, because not everyone can attend all those meetings. So the views of the team and that cross collaboration is really the major thing.
Well, so to be clear, what was the one meeting you cut back on?
Senior management.
My meeting.
It's so efficiently run.
Go on, go on, keep going. Oh, come on.
Unless there's any questions and you really want to talk about meetings for an hour.
So, again, kind of a quality of life measure and just the use of our time that we're trying to focus on. And then kind of following up on that, a little bit of a segue is, as we're managing the overall portfolio, not just our individual portfolios, what analytics do we add to what we already have that helps us be investors collaboratively across the network? Susan and Izzy will work.
Right. So as Ryan mentioned,
so the next topic some of you may have heard, there's a new building in process, UT System. We're destined to be a tenant there, and so Melinda has been coordinating our efforts both with respect to our current space and transitioning to the new space.
So we are, our lease expires here in August of 2016, and at the senior management offsite, we made a decision that we needed to start working on our plans for our new. We agreed to create a committee, which has been done. We've had several meetings. Part of the role of the committee and my position would be to be the interface with the executive committee at the UT System for the replacement office building. And the see staff from the University of Texas System Administration getting involved in projects. Liaison on that for the next few years.
And just to give you an update, we had talked last meeting ago about needing an extension on the lease here. The landlord was only offering a minimum 3-year extension. We didn't want that. And we were able to, fortuitously through a set of relationships, get an 8-year extension. So we've got until February of 2018. So we've got about 8 months after the building scheduled to be completed. So we've got a little cushion there. And you're able to save about $1.5 million by not having to do a 36-month extension.
So it's obviously a long lead time, big impact thing that we're bringing a lot of focus to. The other thing I'd say about this is, what was unique about this offsite is it was very much staff-led. Bruce did not say, here's the things I want us to talk about. He said, you all go and come up with what you want to talk about.
I didn't think you were going to cut back my staff.
Well, careful chance. So out of that, there was a couple things that were very specific to Bruce's role, and those are the last two items. One that we talked a lot about was kind of the staffing and the investing model around the endowment, and we needed to bring more focus and more definition to that because being able to adequately staff the stuff we're doing was really important, but it also had an impact on our new home, how many bodies we need to allow for it. So Bruce, you want to comment on that?
So we're still developing it. You've seen beginning manifestations of our thoughts, this notion of increased specialization, whether it's agriculture or Latin America or IT, you know, not totally abandoning a generalist model, but looking for more specialization so we can get deeper into areas deeper with our partners. We need to have that depth if we're going to be putting people in business and sponsoring partnerships. And so we're working on that. And then big ask.
Can I just give a little perspective on that? So what was so interesting to me about this exercise of going around talking to folks like Kathy, like Joan, Christy, and others, and we were developing this agenda, is we talk a lot about Utimco's history. And what you see, if you study Utimco's history, we found some really interesting old articles, and we talked a lot about how we got to where we are today. And what was really clear was, and Russ, I should also add Russ, and we let Russ and Kathy and Joan get up and give us about a 30-minute history lesson on Utimco that candidly a lot of us relatively newbies didn't know about. What came out of that was the only way we got to where we are today is there were two or three watershed moments in the history of Utimco. One is obviously just the formation of Utimco. And what it tells you is there was a tremendous amount of vision from the UT system leadership that got us where we were, create the entity to begin with. But even before that, there were, you know, the PUF used to be what we call a total return fund. It's very income-oriented and very limited in what it could do. If you fast forward to where we are today, it bears almost no resemblance. And that's a relatively short time span in between where that was and where we are today. And so the whole point that we came to as a group was the only way we got to the platform we're on today is by the wisdom of our predecessors. And the notion is, if we're thinking ahead 10 years, what wisdom can we bring to the table now? Is there a big ask relative to where we are in our maturity that would benefit the next generation in terms of us being proactive? And so we left that kind of Bruce's shot.
Well, when Kathy left, I asked for an extension, but Mark didn't. I've got some ideas. I'll be reaching out to any of you all individually over the next few weeks. And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Jerry, you're standing between lunch and this group.
I'm going to make the court your hand.
We're required to do some training, some director training every year by our contractor, the Board of Regents. And it's intended to focus on the fiduciary obligations that our directors have, with specific emphasis on executive compensation. So I'm going to hit briefly on those, and then I do want to talk a little bit about emails, the Open Meetings Act, and the Open Records Act, or Public Information Act. First of all, as directors of a nonprofit corporation, you have the fiduciary obligations of the duty of care, the duty of loyalty, and the duty of obedience. Duty of care means prepare, attend, and participate. The duty of loyalty is you have to put the interest of your temple above your interest. And you also need, of course, to recognize that your Utenco has a fiduciary obligation to the Board of Regents. They're our client. For-profit directors, their fiduciary objective is to produce value for shareholders. Directors of a nonprofit, your fiduciary obligations are to make sure that the mission of your beneficiaries is being accomplished. So while you have a fiduciary duty to Utenco has a fiduciary duty to the board, thus you have a fiduciary duty to the board. And then the third fiduciary duty you have under Texas law is a duty of obedience. You know, we are really a policy-driven organization. Obedience means that you conform to the governance documents that Utenco lives under. So if you have a problem with a particular policy, we need to fix it because you need to conform your actions to the policies of Utenco. With respect to executive compensation, again, that's something that the Board of Regents requires us to discuss specifically with you. You know, this is an area, this is a very complicated area for any board. It brings together those three fiduciary duties we were just talking about. It also has a unique aspect as it relates to nonprofit boards. The tax law growing out of the United Way fiasco of 10 years ago, it provides that if you pay excess compensation that can amount to inurement to the benefit of a private person, and thus your tax exempt status can be in question. There are safe havens. Now, one of the safe havens is to the extent that you're relying upon market data compiled by an independent organization, such as Mercer, you can create a safe haven so long as your decisions are in line with that market data. You understand I'm oversimplifying everything for the present time. I'm very comfortable with the way that we have we've made compensation decisions. I think we are within the safe haven, but the Board of Regents wanted to make sure that we spoke briefly about that, so I will. I have. The last thing is I want to talk briefly about emails, because emails are a trap. They're a trap both for the Open Meetings Act and for the Public Information Act. The Attorney General takes a view that a meeting doesn't just occur when you sit around the table and you engage in oral conversation, that a meeting can occur through exchanges of emails. A meeting it involves a deliberation of public business. And so, and the Public Information Act will reach not only communication from Utenco to you, but it also will reach communications from you to one another. Regardless whether it's on your personal computer, your personal stationery, whatever. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to wind up by asking you to look briefly at page 51 of my presentation here. Lessons concerning use of emails. it's almost never a good idea for a director to send an email concerning public business or public policy to a quorum of the board or a committee of the board. Emails should not be forwarded from one director to another in a matter that may create a walking quorum. Part of the presentation that I skipped was a brief recitation of a situation in 2003 when two current and one former member of the State Board of Education were indicted for having a walking quorum. Again, the Open Meetings Act is a penal statute, and there were three financial advisors, two current members of the board, former member of the board. They met at Katz's Delicatessen, and you'd have a director sitting at one table talking to a financial advisor and another director sitting at another table and a former director sitting at a third, and there was sort of a round robin. That gave rise to a walking quorum, and there were indictments issued. I don't recall the outcome of that. It's not as important as the fact that they were indicted. I don't think anyone could be convicted. But so as you consider emails from you to another, just be aware that those emails are subject to disclosure and that they can give rise to a walking quorum.
Wait a second.
Yes, sir.
We are in executive session yesterday where we are deliberating individual compensation goals.
That's correct.
I want to distribute something to the committee to discuss in open in executive session, and I sent that around yesterday. So is that advisable or inadvisable? How do we handle making sure the committee has all the materials for discussion?
I had that conversation with Lee last evening.
Okay.
I think it is fine. Send information to others. I think it's preferable to the extent it can come from staff as opposed to come from you, but I think it's fine to do that. I think it would be inadvisable if you then had separate conversations with each one of these people that for the purpose of discussing that information.
I forwarded a staff email.
Yeah. The important thing is I'm trying to really raise the sensitivity to, and then, of course, and what we've been talking about is open meetings. You know, and I learned this, I learned a hard lesson about this when I was on the board of tech, and that is that when you compose an email related to public business, you should think about how comfortable you'd be if it was received with editorial board at Houston Chronicle. And that's another point that I made here. And then another thing I said was when you receive an email concerning public business or public policy that was sent to a quorum of the board, it's almost never a good idea to hit reply all and share your thoughts with respect to that. I'm certainly available to talk to any of you. By the way, with respect to the duty of obedience, I hate to jump back, but I'm trying to get this done quickly. The duty of obedience, there's a large obligation on the staff and perhaps on me also to make sure that you comply with the duty of obedience, that you don't participate in ultra-virus, that you do conform to policies. So that's kind of on us in addition to being on you. I'll be happy to go through the rest of these 51 pages if you'd like, Mr. Chairman, but I can tell by your smirk you did not. So
I can add that if your email is a sure winner and or it's really clever, don't use it.
My experience in 7 years on the NM board is no idea what's
happening. You know,
their phone.
What's the fun in that?
Well, okay.
You're right. You're absolutely right.
Anyway, there's
an O-Saw that I shared with Arden recently, and that is, you know, if you can speak, don't write.
If you can nod, don't speak. If you can wink, don't nod.
I have trouble with some of that. Thank you, Jerry.
Yes,
it's always important to hear from you on these items, because often we get so involved in what we're doing in the business that we forget some of the traps, if you will, we walk ourselves into. Why don't we have committee meetings report out. Why don't we grab our lunch, come back, we'll pick up some time. What I'd suggest in 15-20 minutes, we